believe the UWA people are still coming, so do we mind if we just wait a few minutes, or do you think that we should?
Why don't I just give an overview of the program?
Yes, of course, Jane. Okay, so I'll just start. So welcome, everyone. It's wonderful to have everyone here from the different universities, and we've had great pleasure this morning to talk to the American Council of Educators. So it's the ACE fellows who have been visiting various universities in Australia. And we have Dr. Joanne Goodall, Dr. Rosalie Rush, and Dr. Janelle
Chisera.
And so I'm going to hand over to Joanne to just give a little bit of an overview of the ACE fellows and a little bit of background why they're looking at what we're doing here in Australia. So welcome and thank you.
Thanks very much, Sue, for having us. It's been a long time planning. I think I emailed Sue back in September, maybe last year. And Louisa, thank you very much. So the ACE Fellows Program, ACE is the American Council on Education. It's been established for about 60 years, I believe, and the Fellows Program has been going for 50 years. So we're actually cohort 51. That's the 51st group of people to do it. There are 41 people in the cohort, and you spend up to a year engaged in another university away from your home campus at a host campus. And while you're on that host campus, you're working with senior leadership, usually the president, the provost, or a senior vice president for something that matches your area of interest and or expertise. While you're at the host campus, you can work on a variety of different projects as assigned by your mentor, or you can just be like I was, sitting around in meetings, giving my advice when it was asked for and listening and learning. So I've had a really great year of listening and learning. It's a very different position to be in when you've been in a position of responsibility at your home institution to go somewhere else and be a fly on the wall, is basically where I've been. But everyone's had different roles in their host institution. You also have to do a project for your home institution, and we've all done different things, and mine was looking at how to increase the profile of teaching on our campus, because we've done a lot of things to help improve student success around administrative and advising and other kinds of student support mechanisms, but we've not really looked at what goes on in the classroom. I'm a teacher educator. I was a maths teacher here in Perth for 13 years before I started doing my PhD. And Vicky, I just said Vicky, who I worked with years ago when I was here at Curtin. So I'm a Curtin grad. I have 4 degrees from Curtin University, one of which was weight, of course, so that's how old I am, which is really old. So we spend the year at our home host institution. We also attend 3 multi-day retreats in various locations. Our first one last year was in Detroit, Michigan. The second one was in Miami, and our third one will be in Washington, D.C., just a week after we all get back. And we do various professional development type activities around leadership. We've looked at budgeting models and enrollment management trends and how to work on fundraising and you name it. As a higher ed admin issue, we've looked at it in some degree or not. Also, another thing we did was a case study of 2 institutions, a fictional institution and a real institution. The fictional institution is kind of like a stalwart of the program. It's called Pennyfield College, and we all feel like it's a rite of passage for every fellow to do the Pennyfield case study. So you're sitting around at midnight on the day before you're supposed to be giving your presentation about Pennyfield with 5 of your colleagues, wondering how on earth you're going to put all this together. So it's that kind of thing. It's really more of a morale and camaraderie building kind of activity, but it has some practical applications as well. And then the real case study was at a college called Marygrove College, which I just found out that Rosalie's mother is an alumni of. Marygrove College is a small private Catholic institution with an enrollment of about 2,000 students, and like many of those kinds of institutions in the US, they're experiencing some difficulties with enrollment and budget management and so on. So we, as a group, all 41 of us, spent an entire day at the campus talking with their leadership. various different groups at different aspects of the university. So we've had a huge variety of experiences. This tour is the culminating event for the three of us. We left a colleague in Melbourne. She's gone up to Cairns, which she still can't say. She can't say the word Cairns. It's so funny. She's gone up to Cairns with her mother, who came on the trip of a lifetime with her daughter to come to Australia. So we visited Sydney. We went to Western Sydney as our first stop. We met Barney Glover. Many of you will know him from his time here at Curtin. He's the Vice-Chancellor there now. Then we went to the University of Technology, Sydney, and Sydney University for two shorter visits. Then we went to Melbourne, and we visited Australian Catholic University and the University of Melbourne one day, and the next day we went to Victoria University and Monash, and then we came here yesterday with you today for the entire day, which has been fantastic because the other visits have been quite short and we haven't had much of a chance to interact with people at a sort of deeper level, so this has been really excellent. And I really thank the National Centre for sponsoring us and helping us, putting this day together for us. It's been really excellent so far. So that's about it. Do you want to say something?
Thank you very much for hosting us today.
And I'll probably just ask Luke to give you a bit of background of colleagues who are sitting here in on this session because they're from each of the universities. So, Luke, did you just want
to... Sure, yeah. So my name's Luke. I work here at Curtin University in the Ethics, Equity and Social Justice Office. And we've, over the almost 2 years now, we've formed a WA collective of equity practitioners, so linked to the National FER Equity Practitioners in Higher Education Australasia body. We've created a WA committee. So we meet quarterly to discuss our activities and ways that we can work together, particularly around raising aspirations for people to attend university. So it seemed like a great opportunity to kind of combine our collective activities today. So.
Thank you. That's excellent. Very good.
So we might get started because I know that we're running on a bit of a timeline. So Joanne, would you like to begin?
Okay, so the three of us are going to talk. How would we prefer to do this? Should we do the three presentations and then have a general discussion at the end? Would that be better? Okay, so we'll do that. You know, if there's a specific question that you have, Jeff, for clarification, please don't hesitate to ask as we go through. But I'll be talking about performance-based funding and its implications for equity students. Janelle's talking about the development of an institutional equity plan that she constructed at her host institution, Clemson University. And Rosalie is talking about emergency communications and her experiences with that at her home institution Bloomsburg. Thank you. Okay, so we're not going to talk for too long. We'll definitely leave you with these slides and you're welcome to use them if you wish. And most of it's to give sort of a high-level overview just to give spark some conversation around these issues. So that's me. So just to give you an idea of the trends in funding sources and where the money comes from in the US, as you can see, there are three basic pots of money that universities get in the United States: tuition, state and local appropriations, and federal appropriations, including grants and contracts. They're the three main big pots of money. You can see there that the state and local appropriations have been going down precipitously in all types of institutions across the top of the four different categories of institutions that we usually look at in the US. Those are institutions that grant doctoral degrees and everything else, institutions that grant up to a master's degree or up to a bachelor's degree, or the two-year institutions. We call those community colleges. But you can see at each type of institution, the percentage of state funding has been going down over the past 10 years. When I first started at my home institution, we were actually over 40%. We were 50%. We are a doctoral granting institution. And this year, I think we're down to about 24% of our funding coming from the state appropriations. You'll see that the other two pots of money are kind of static. So, you know, what goes up comes down, or whatever the saying may be, but because the state appropriations are going down, the biggest impact, of course, on our students is that the tuition is going up. and that's been consistent over all of those sectors, as I mentioned. So what are some of the state funding models that are used? Most institutions previously were on a base plus-minus kind of model. So there was an amount that was allocated based on a particular kind of formula, and then you would either get additions or subtractions on that based on how you met those targets in the formula. In 1979, Tennessee was the first institution to introduce performance-based funding, and it took quite a while for Ohio, which is the state I work in, to jump on board in 1995 with some performance-based measures, and followed quite a long time again after that by Indiana in 2007. Most of those programs, or all of those programs in that period, were termed performance funding 1.0, where they provided a bonus on top of regular funding. So there were just some performance targets that universities could choose to meet or not, and then they would get a little bit extra based on whether they met those targets or not. Now we've all moved to performance funding 2.0, where the money that you receive from the state is pretty much all based on the meaning of these equity, of these metrics, of these performance targets. I think Tennessee is actually nearly up to 100% performance-based funding now. By June of 2014, 26 states had some level of performance funding, and now it's 36 and it's increasing. So I think, you know, it's like a copycat kind of thing, and, you know, the policy papers will say the same thing. It spreads gradually from one to the other, and they look from one state to the next. So unlike Australia, you know, the states have a lot of say in the policies at the state level for universities, because they are all legislated within the state. There are very few. Are there any national universities? I don't think there are. There is no national university. So the old models were all based on inputs. So in Australian vernacular, it was bums on seats. You got a student, you got a dollar from the state, or however many dollars. Oh, I'm so sorry, we had to start without you.
That's okay.
There's some seats there. There's some seats there and some seats there. So I'm just talking about the performance funding in the US and getting a little bit of background about some of those models and how they've been developed over the last some years. So, so the old models were all based on inputs, so the number of students, the instructional costs, how much it cost to maintain the plant, capital improvements that were needed, and so on, and these were all applied for and dished out on sometimes an equitable and sometimes an inequitable basis. The move towards performance funding is an attempt, I think, to try and even out the playing field in some regard, to divide up the limited funding in a different way. Now, with the performance funding metrics, most of them are based on course completion. So that means, in our language, a grade of A, B, or C, and no grades of D, which is considered below par, or F, which is fail, or W, which is withdraw. So the student, the money is only awarded if the student receives a grade A, B, or C in the course. So, you know, if you think about that as a faculty member and as a college or a department, that has huge implications for what goes on in the classroom and changes the, changes the game really quite considerably in terms of what you do and how you treat your students and, how students can progress through their courses. They are also based on graduation rates, and just to give you some idea, when I first started at Cleveland State, there were no performance funding models. As I said, there we had a very small amount of it, but there was no focus on graduation rates or retention rates, and there was no conversation about it at the university. No one ever mentioned it, no one knew what the numbers are, and I'll talk a little bit about that in more detail later. Retention rates. Retention is usually measured between the first and the second year of college. So everyone is really working hard now so to improve those retention rates to keep the first year students. So obviously there's a lot of focus on what happens to students now in that first year, and how prepared they are for university studies or not has a big impact on whether they are retained. And in some states, employment rates are also used. Our colleague Kim, who is not with us today, mentioned a number of times in other conversations we've had that when you ask a legislator what is success for a university or how do you measure that, they will say the number of graduates employed after 1 year out of college. That's what they're interested in. They want to know how many people are getting jobs straight out of the programs and what jobs the programs are leading to. So that's causing a lot of consternation in the liberal arts because not every degree leads to a job and not every program is a professionally focused program. So, you know, there's a lot of conversation going on around all of those things because of this switch to performance-based funding. So just to give you an idea, that was a graph I found the other day. The green are implementing as of FY 2015, if my glasses are helping me read that far. Is that correct?
Yes.
Developing are the blue states, and the grey ones, there's nothing happening in these terms there. But you can see it's very widespread, and I'm sure before long it will be across the entire US. So the state, this is taken from the state of Ohio's policy implementation rationale and how the state has said it's going to and why it wants to implement performance-based funding. Firstly, they have tried, I think, to engage stakeholders across the state in having input onto how the metrics are developed. There's a group of university presidents within Ohio. There are 14 state universities. Only the state universities get state funding. By the way, the privates do not get state funding. So this money is coming from the state to the state-funded universities. So there's 14 of those in the university in the state of Ohio. And they meet regularly, once every couple of months. And this is obviously a big topic of discussion. And there's a lobbyist who lobbies the state legislature on behalf of the 14 presidents. And a lot of that lobbying is around how the metrics are developed and how they are implemented. So, you know, the political nature of this is obvious because the money is coming from the legislature and every extra bit of money that is allocated could be coming to your campus, so it's in your own interest to do that. They do use a limited set of consistently defined metrics, so everyone is held to the same standard, which may or may not be equitable depending on how you choose to define equity. There is differentiation across each institution, with their different missions and their different populations. So there are some mechanisms within it to try and compensate for institutions like my institution, which is or was an open access, completely open access, that means no entrance requirements. We now have some entrance requirements, but the vast majority of our students are extremely low socioeconomic status and many of them first-gen students. So, you know, our population is very different to Ohio State University, which is in Columbus, the flagship land-grant university, who now say, you know, their entry requirements have gone up considerably because they want to keep their population at around about 60, 70,000 students. So, you know, we're in the growth phase. We don't want to, you know, we're not restricting our enrollment at all, as long as they meet some fairly basic admission requirements. But, you know, there are some mechanisms built in, but, of course, we would argue that they could be more friendly to us because of the nature of our student body. They do try and focus on student completion by incentivising the success of at-risk students. So there are some bonuses in there, if you like, for being more successful with the at-risk student. Most of our funding now, I couldn't find the actual percent, but it's something like 60% of our state funding is based on these metrics. But when it changed, that was a big change, and some of us stood to lose a little bit, and some of us stood to lose a lot, others stood to gain a lot because of the change in the way it went. So they did have a phase-in period, and they did have some hold harmless dollars so that, you know, if your institution was going to be significantly impacted in a negative way, there was some bridge funding to ease that transition until everyone caught up with and got on board with the new ways of funding and being able to, you know, develop those programs and policies in the university to improve their outcomes. So there has been some attempt to ease the impact on institutions as they've gone through. So in Ohio, we've got 40% for degree completion, 50% for degree completion, I should say. 30% for course completion, about, you know, 19.7 for doctoral and medical programs as a surplus, as an additional funding on top of that, and 0.3% set aside for special projects, and that's how they've divided it up in Ohio. But what have been some of the implications for the institutions, and I'm talking generally now across the entire, you know, all of the institutions. So because of this pot of money, it's always a zero-sum game. If I win, you lose. You know, so that creates even more competition between the institutions. There's been a lot of program prioritisation, which means looking at every program, looking at its outputs, and determining those ones that are not helping us on our performance metrics, and perhaps closing those programs down. So what do you do with the faculty? What happens to the students? What happens to the facilities? So there's a lot of implications, you know, that are you know, playing out in that regard. Programs with low enrollment, low graduation numbers, and low job placement rates, you know, stand to be eliminated. And you can think, it doesn't take too long to think of what kinds of programs they might be. You know, they may not be job-focused. They may be non-professional type programs, you know, with a much stronger liberal arts focus. So that's under real pressure from this performance funding. Those programs are feeling the pinch. And we've certainly amalgamated and eliminated some of our religious studies and philosophy programs at my university, which I don't think is a good thing. So these, you know, and then you look down to past the program level to the course level. So courses that aren't required for graduation are being eliminated. So that then, you know, lessens the choice of students, lessens the breadth of their education. And that, you know, that may or may not be a good thing, but, you know, these are just some of the implications that are occurring as a result of these conversations. Courses considered roadblocks, like mathematics, might be diminished, are being really heavily scrutinised. Maybe the quality will diminish. Maybe the quality of the degree will diminish. We don't know the answers to these questions yet, because these really hard level, as I would call, you know, serious performance-based funding initiatives have only been in for a couple of years, and we're not really seeing the impact, and very little research has been done around some of these questions that I'm raising here, which is where some of you might be interested in looking. Like I say, I think I already mentioned this, some institutions have increased admission requirements to keep out those less qualified students, which obviously impacts our equity students. The increasing emphasis on course and degree completion is probably a good thing. And in fact, the data would suggest that there have been a big increase in the number of degrees awarded in Ohio since this came into fruition, into being. But again, that could also be impacted by a lot of other factors as well, so that the research is nascent here. It really needs a lot more research to really understand what's going on. Obviously, if you're receiving pressure to increase your completion rate in courses, you may be also thinking about decreasing your standards. For the most part, there hasn't been any check on that. People and institutions have relied on the faculty to maintain those standards. And that may be okay if you have an institution with a large number of full-time faculty, but for many of us, we have a lot of part-time faculty who, not that their standards of quality are any less, but when you are dealing with a large number of sessional staff teaching in a program where there may be a lot of turnover of those staff, it's very hard, even in normal times, to maintain quality. And if you're being told we've got to get as many students through as possible or we're going to lose funding, you know, that message, whether it be forceful or subliminal, is there, and I think there's a real danger in that regard. On the good side, Ohio now gets $4,000 per student who graduates. That's one number. Of course, that number fluctuates depending on the pool of money, but it's been around that, which has led some institutions to look at students who don't graduate for very small amounts of debt to the university. And that happens a lot more than we as faculty and administrators knew about. Some students would not graduate for a debt of $300 It may all be parking fines. You know, are we going to hold a student back from graduating because they have a parking problem with parking? Well, you know, now we've introduced, and so there's been a lot of work around that from some of the big foundations, this idea of completion grants. So, you know, a university can, and the university I've been at, Kent State University, is my host institution. The president set aside $200,000, no, $300,000 next year for completion grants, but partly as a result of my pushing them. So that was one of the things I did. I think, yeah, I think you should be doing this. I think you should be doing completion grants. Completion grants are a really good idea. Here's all this information from the Lumina Foundation. Here's all this information from, you know, so while I wasn't specifically involved in doing that program, I provided the input, and they're very happy. You know, the provost in particular was thrilled that he was able to convince the president, based on information I provided them, that the completion grant was a good idea. So those kinds of things are happening, and I think that's a very good thing for some of our equity students, and for all students who are in that position. We've made a big push on advising. So when I first started at the university, we had very few professional advisors. Most of the course and career advising was done by faculty to, in some cases, very high standard, and in some cases, to a very poor standard. And so students were often led down the wrong path with poor advice about what courses to take, or no advice, and taking the wrong courses off their own, you know, because they didn't know. So, you know, they didn't read the handbook or the, you know, course manual or whatever it was. And we did away with compulsory advising. We just didn't really have enough people. Now, of course, because completion and degree completion in particular is such a big focus, a lot of effort has been put into that, into advising. Still, there's still issues around advising because those professional advisors don't have to have any licence or any, there's no, you know, level of degree required. I mean, some of them have masters in counselling, some of them hold PhDs in counselling. So, you know, the quality is very uneven. There's some really great ones and some that, you know, certainly are not so great, just as there were in faculty. But for the most part, I think students are getting a lot better advice on what classes to take when and how to navigate through the monolithic, for the most part, curriculums in the United States universities. And then the other thing that's happening is that there are now for-profit companies set up to analyse each university's data when you pay them $150,000 for the privilege of doing so, that will give back to the university early warning signs of students who are likely to drop out. So they'll take, at the university, my host institution, Kent State, this is exactly what has happened. So they hand over their university data set of all of their student records with all of the demographic information about every student and every course completion and every enrollment and withdrawal and, you know, the whole everything. Give it to this company called EAB, Education Advisory Board, and they do their magic and they send back, you know, lists of students or groups of students who are in danger of, you know, dropping out of this course or dropping out of that program or not making it to the end or, you know, all of those things. And they get that information is given back to the advisors, and then the advisors have to have the conversation with the student. Well, there's a whole other level of advising that goes on there too, because what do you do when you call a student into your room? You say, oh, we've been given an early warning about that you're going to drop out. That might be a bit, you know, disconcerting for a student to hear that they're on a target list of dropouts. So, you know, there's a whole lot more work that has to go on with advisors to make sure that the messaging is, you know, sent and received correctly in terms of these kinds of advising in interactions. A couple of the institutions that we... Did you go to Georgia State?
Yes.
So Georgia State is a famous institution that's done a lot of work in this area, along with Arizona State, and I visited both of those as part of my fellowship just a couple of weeks back. And at Georgia State, they have 800 indicators that they analyse about every student every night. Their computers run every night analysing these indicators. So if you put in, as an advisor, that you saw student X today and they said something like, you know, well, you know, my mother's really sick and I might have to take some time off, that goes into the data system and that's counted in the, you know, so then if the student is absent the next week, then that goes into the data system, and, you know, then if the student doesn't hand in an assignment the next week, that goes into the data system, and then, you know, then the advisor goes, hang on, sick, absent, no assignment, this student's in trouble, I should contact that student, I should reach out to that student. And that happens every single day. And so they have, you know, they have so much information and so much analytics going on about every student every day. They have been able to just make incredible strides with their retention and completion at Georgia State. So if you really want to know about how to do it well, go look at Georgia State, because they really have done incredible work, along with Arizona State, who is the biggest university now in the United States. They have 70,000 on-campus students and 20,000 completely online students for a student population of 90,000 students. And their mantra from their president is, we will be known by the students we enroll, not the students we keep out. So his, you know, his thing is innovate and grow rather than let's stay static and only take the students who meet our standards and let's keep raising those standards so we can keep all those other ones out. You know, so there's some fascinating, amazing things going on. So just a very quick little bit about Clinton State. So when I first started, the graduation rate was never discussed. It was a dirty little secret that we were actually the lowest of all of the 14 state universities in Ohio. I think it was something like 25%. So that means only 25% of the students who started graduated within 6 years, not 4 years. The four-year graduation rate was something like 10% or less, 9%. So when we got a new president in 2009 and we were transitioning into this performance funding model with the metrics based on the performance of first-time, full-time freshmen, that's what that FDFDF means, he really brought the focus on student success, and we formed an undergraduate committee on student success with faculty and administrators, and those people worked very closely with the registrar, the bursar and the financial aid office to make sure that any kind of administrative barrier was removed, any kind of graduation barrier to graduation was removed as much as possible, so that everyone really, you know, people really benefited from that. We implemented web-based degree audit software so the students can now go in and see exactly which courses they've got, that they've completed and which they have to still have to complete, so they can see where they are. We implemented degree maps so that everyone knows this is the best way to take these courses, so, you know, in this sequence. And as a result, we've improved our graduation rates quite a lot. I think we're up to almost 40% now. So another thing we did also, which was a very big thing, was, and it was during my tenure as Faculty Senate President, was to realign our entire curriculum. So we changed it from 128 credits required for degree to 120 credits required for degree. We changed it from a basically 4-credit model to a 3-credit model, so that we are more in line with the entire country, which also runs on a 3-credit model. But it wasn't without controversy. We had quite a number of very heated meetings, which I had to chair, and we had a vote of no confidence in the president and the administration, which the president reminded me of just a couple of weeks ago when I had lunch with him. So it was a very sore point for him. But we did it, and we did it in 1 year, and that convinced me that when we really need to do something, we actually did it, and it's been a great benefit to the students. We did lose some tuition in that first year because of the changes, but now with this graduation rate of almost 40%, I think we've really shown that those things have made a big difference to our students, and hopefully will continue to do so. My project was for my home institution, I think I mentioned, was to improve focus on teaching, because while we've done all of those things, most of them have been focused on students and what happens to students outside of the classroom. We haven't focused on what happens to students inside of the classroom. And I was with Shirley Alexander. She said the other day at UTS, the biggest thing she felt that she did was at the beginning of her tenure as DPC academic is to change the conversation from teaching to learning. But what is happening to students while they are learning in the classrooms? Not what you are doing as teachers, but how are the students learning? And that's definitely something I'm taking back. Not that it wasn't my focus, but this is, it really has, you know, convinced me that that needs to be our focus. So that's it. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think it's important to also note that with Georgia State University, they completely revised their visor structure. They have professional visors. They also looked at what is the group or the subpopulation of students that they could be most effective with, and so they called them the murky middle. So they didn't go after every group of student population on campus.
Right.
They went to that group that they could really make a change with, and they started to grow from there.
Okay, I'm going to turn the conversation just a little bit from performance-based funding, although there are some implications for an equity plan on campuses, but focus a lot on developing an institutional equity plan. There's my information up there for you if any of you have any questions. My email is there. I am at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, which is my home institution. It's a research-intensive public university with an academic health center associated with it, and I am being hosted by Clemson University, which is a public institution that's a land-grant institution. So very, very little academic health on that campus, a lot more agriculture and on that campus. So I always think it's important to start out with definitions. Definitions because it can be a little murky for you to understand kind of where we're coming from when we talk about things like diversity and inclusion and equity. So I wanted to start out by just defining some of those terms. So for diversity across the country, what people in the United States often confuse this with is the fact that it's a black and white issue. And in America, it's really not. In the United States right now, it's much more comprehensive. It's much more complex than that. So we're really talking about diversity, meaning individual differences within our students, our faculty, and our staff, and also group social differences that can be engaged in the service of learning across our campuses. And so that it can include things like personality differences, learning style differences, sexual orientation, ability status, as well as a whole host of others like political, religious, and other affiliations that students have. Inclusion, on the other hand, is more about kind of this intentional engagement that we have with diversity on our campus, in the people that we hire and the students that we have, in our curriculum, in our co-curricular activities, and as well in our communities in which people connect. And people connect in order to increase awareness, to increase content knowledge, to increase cognitive sophistication, and to understand and have empathy for one another and the complex nature of what those relationships really look like. So when I think about diversity and inclusion on US, in U.S. institutions, diversity really is about numbers. It's about the number of people, faculty, staff, and students that we can bring to our campus, and inclusion is about the climate and the culture that we build. And there was a great article I read about a year ago where they actually differentiated between those two, as diversity being all about being invited to the party, and inclusion being all about being asked to dance when you're at the party. And those are not mutually exclusive. And on U.S. campuses, we cannot keep these things separate. And that's because there have been situations where people have increased their numbers of diverse student, diverse faculty, diverse staff. They did not include the inclusion piece and lost those people within 3 years' time. So all the effort and energy and money that went into it really didn't do much good for that institution. So those are really taken together. For equity, this is really about creating opportunities on our campuses to help students from underrepresented populations have equal access to and participation in a lot of the educational programs that we have on our campus. So I just wanted to make sure that we understood what that is. As an academic, I always feel like it's important for you to understand the historical context of U.S. higher ed, and that we really have been working on this forever. And I will tell you, we don't have a magic bullet here. So while Joanne talked a lot about some people that are doing some best practices, in the field of diversity and equity, there really isn't a best practice that exists. Often what we do is we look at a few other institutions as far as what they're doing, and we tweak what they do to fit the culture that exists at our institution. And that's what's different from something like performance-based funding versus something like diversity, which is very much part of the culture of an institution. So in the for the nearly 400-year history that we've had in higher education, the primary purpose over those years was primarily at the purview of the elite. So it was really about the haves getting the education and the have-nots not getting the education that was out there. And it wasn't until 1869 when a gentleman named Charles Eliot, who actually was the president of Harvard, actually created this paradigm of education that pretty much exists today in U.S. higher education. And his vision really shifted American higher education from a pedagogy that was really steeped in kind of this recitation and classical Greek and Latin training to this education model that works on the elective system of courses that really exists in the American population now. And that probably is a little bit similar to what you have here in Australia. In the 1800s, we had women's colleges that actually started way back in the early 1800s, as well as African-American institutions. And in fact, one of those institutions started back in 1854, which was the Ashman Institute, which is now called Lincoln University, that had its charter from the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania in 1854. And it was, therefore, the first degree-granting what we call historically black college and university that we had. So way back then, Wilberforce University was, it has its history traced before the Civil War. So I'm also going to talk a little bit about the Civil War here in a minute. So their history, Wilberforce University, started before the Civil War when the Ohio Underground Railroad was started. And this was a railroad where blacks from the south were seeking refuge up north. And so they were using these underground railroads, and one of the stops was Wilberforce University, which was really an institutional mecca and refuge from slavery's first rule, which was ignorance. So this was a great way to kind of move against that kind of mantra. So in the early 1800s, this was the first time that they really started altering the view of U.S. higher education only being for white males when they started these women colleges, as well as the African-American, the historically black colleges and universities in the 1800s. The 1800s, also in the mid-1800s, saw a major boost to American higher education at that time with something called the Morrill Land-Grant Act. And there were two land-grant acts. There was one in 1862, which was called the Land-Grant College Act, and there was another one in 1890 toward the bottom of the slide, which was called the Agricultural College Act of 1890. A lot of people believe that this is where U.S. higher education became democratized, but that's not quite the case where it exists. It became more utilitarian in nature than it was democratized, and I'll talk a little bit about that here. So the Land-Grant College Act was started by a congressman out of Vermont. His name was Justin Smith Morrill. And it was signed by Abraham Lincoln on July 2nd in 1862. And what this act did was it provided grants to each state. It provided them 30,000 acres of public land in each state per senator and per representative. And what the states did at that time was they sold that land, and then they created an endowment. And within each state, they were supposed to at least build one college within that state. And off to the right, it tells you really what the reason for the endowment really was, to support the maintenance of at least one college, where the leading object shall be, toward the bottom, to promote the liberal and practical education of the industrial classes in the several pursuits and professions in life. So this really not only provided an institution that helped what I think is more democratizing higher education, but it really kept that shift from the classical studies to the applied studies moving forward. A lot of these land-grant institutions focused very hard on agriculture, which at that time, about 60 to 70% of the people were engaged in agriculture, and the whole identity around those institutions was to take that theory and get it out into the farmlands. Now, in 2009, 2015, I think we're down at about 2%. So we're thinking about our value from a little different setting. Since that first land grant act, 69 colleges were funded through that first land grant act. And I put a bullet on here that said the land grant act has improved the lives of millions of people. And what I should have done was put a couple of question marks after that. Because I think, yes, it did improve the lives of millions of Americans, but what you have to understand is very early on, the Civil War was going on, and there was kind of this separation of races. So in the South, in the United States, this was a time where the blacks were not allowed to attend those institutions that were built off that first land grant. So to counteract that, the 1890 Land Grant Act came up, and that was called the Agricultural College Act of 1890. And this was specifically aimed at the Southern Confederate States, saying you're going to do one of two things. You're either going to show that race is not an admission criteria with the land grant institutions that exist right now, or the second thing is you're going to designate a separate land grant institution for persons of color that were separate but equal is what they had called them. So that separate land grant act actually resulted in the development of 17 historically black colleges and universities in the Confederate States. And today there's probably about, I just looked this up, 105 land grant institutions that exist right now. And what's very interesting about this is the Justin Smith Morrill is someone who never really had a college degree at all. So the person who started democratizing higher education and allowing it to be available for the majority, well, I don't even want to say majority, but for a lot of people across the U.S. Actually didn't have a college degree himself. So there are a lot of people that argue about whether or not the Morrill Act really resulted in democratizing higher ed. I think it's more utilitarian in nature. It took that education and made it based in what they call extension units, where you could get that theory out into practice. It wasn't until the 1920s when higher education was identified as a period where education was pretty much democratized at this time. So it went from being education for the elite in the 1920s to mass public education. In the 1960s, if any of you remember the 60s, I know in the United States we remember the 60s well. This brought a whole new group of students to campus that were politically charged. And so these people on campus actually had a voice and started to protest. And basically, this is where you first started to see this breakdown between the barrier of higher education and political issues that exist on in the U.S. These students were socially concerned students, and they were loud about it at that time. So they challenged higher education to broaden its mission. So even though we think it had a broader mission, they really challenged higher education to broaden that mission to address what we considered at that time to be America's complex social problems. And that really focused around race and minority status issues. We had, of course, in the 1960s, a civil rights movement that existed. And I will tell you, during this period of time, when you think about higher education and things that are happening in the landscape, you often think about it from the standpoint of an impact that it has on higher ed. And I will tell you that higher education did not address the deeper implication of race on campus during this time, even though there was a lot of racial tensions that were going on at that time. In 1975, Title IX regulations became effective as law. Some of you may have heard of Title IX. Title IX really says no person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity in the United States that receives federal financial assistance. It wasn't really until the 1980s, although they were pretty active in the 1960s, it really wasn't until the 1980s when race became a major issue. And it became a major issue in the intergroup relations that existed on our campuses, in the curriculum that we offered, in the professoriates that we had, and the allocation of resources that we had on our campuses. And basically, from the 1980s on, it really moved us to this period where we saw this diversity divide, or what we call a diversity divide in the United States, which is really this disjuncture between rhetoric of inclusion on our campuses and what is actually existing on our campuses. So today, there's still this growing disconnect between higher education and diversity. And what's interesting is this issue that's going on right now. We are having serious demographic changes in the United States. where as soon as 2025, 2050, we will have a minority majority in our demographics in the United States, which we haven't seen before. The problem is we have a cultural lag. There's been radical changes in the environment around us from a demographic perspective, but on campuses, we have not seen that same radical change in the climates that we have on our campuses. And this is what's leading to serious issues on campuses across our country. And I could have spent an hour showing you examples of racial tensions that exist for all groups, whether it be LGBTQ, which is the lesbian, gay, trans, bisexual community, as well as minority groups, women. I could have, spent an hour talking about that. I just had a few examples that are actually on the slide there. So I will tell you that the last 2 years in higher education in the United States, this has been really a fire point for a lot of presidents here. There are a lot of presidents and chancellors of systems who have lost their job over racial tensions that have existed, and a lot of it is because of a failure to communicate or a failure to listen and act on what people were asking for. So I want to show you just a little movie here. This is one of our PhD students at Clemson University. He graduated this May with a PhD in rhetoric. And this is actually going to give you an example of some of the racial tensions that actually exist on campus. If you know anything about U.S. higher education, we are really big into our college athletics. So on Clemson's campus, it's no different. So we're really big into football, really big into basketball. And the point that you're going to see A.D. Carson making here is that at Clemson University, our mascot is the Tiger. And the Tiger is kind of an orange color with stripes. All the focus on Clemson's campus right now is about the orange. And what members from the African-American population are saying is, what makes up a full tiger is the orange and the black stripes. So what they're really fighting for right now is that the university start to focus on the stripes. So A.D. Carson came up with this poem, as well as a little story called See the Stripes, so you can get a kind of a sense of what's going on U.S. campuses.
The sight of the most exciting 25 seconds in college football was made possible by profits from the most shameful centuries in America's history. But come to the campus of Clemson University and you'd hardly be able to tell it from looking around. Solid orange, you'll see. The grounds are perfectly manicured, alluring, and monuments to the greatness that create such institutions stand as reminders from whence we came, and since we gain so much from what we see, we smile. Proud of the great tradition of which we have the benefit of saying we are now a part. Solid orange we are. And it's easy to buy in. It starts with the song that shakes the Southland and a sea of solid orange, tiger rags that kind of grab you and say, you are now a member of this family. You are now a Clemson Tiger. We're your orange proud. But it's pretty well known fact that tigers have stripes, and almost as well known as the reason they do, yet Clemson University, home of the Tigers, doesn't do much acknowledging of those dark marks it knows to be so integral a part of its existence. Solid orange, we say, at this university that was once a plantation, slavery being the positive good, according to Master Calhoun, whose house sits still on a plot atop a hill overlooking the football field. Open 7 days a week, and I can even enter through the front door. What I cannot do, however, is depend on the tour guide to give me the whole history of the foundations of my university, because for some reason or another, it's uncomfortable for some people to talk about slave owners, supremacists, and segregationists on those terms. Or it's unknown to the individual responsible for the dissemination of that information about this place. But 24 and many more years ago, our forefathers brought forth on this continent our forefathers and our foremothers, and exploited them for hundreds of years, which led to our being conceived in captivity and dedicated to the proposition that history is a matter of telling the story that makes us look best. Solid orange, I think. And that forces me to confront my active participation in not only the crime, but the cover-up. The whitewashing with orange of the dark parts of the history meant to be instructional lest we repeat it. I repeatedly walked past the Strom Thurmond Institute of Government and Public Affairs and wondered, was it there that our ancestors were built? Because it happened. Slavery was big business, and being black meant you made profits to keep your master in the black. And if the master went into the red, he'd see red, and you'd likely wear red stripes across your back. And if that is an uncomfortable truth for the institution, so be it. These are the stripes we bear. So see them. Slavery, sharecropping, and convict labor paved the streets and sidewalks of this high seminary of learning, and earning a degree from here tethers me to the legacy of that and John C. Calhoun, Strom Thurmond, Thomas Green Clinton, and Pitchfork Ben Tillman, who, with his henchmen, killed black members of a militia, never to be convicted but elected to public office, governor, to have statues and buildings erected in his honor eventually. The one on this beautiful campus houses the Calhoun Honors College and the School of Education. So be it if it's uncomfortable to bear those stripes. See them. Because it's not uncomfortable to reap the benefits of the labor that went into building the business attending the land, but very much so, knowing the buildings and the land are stained with years upon years of the blood, sweat, and tears of slaves and sharecroppers and so-called criminals who were led to the institution to do the work that needed doing. Orange, they say. And I say, the tiger cannot survive without its stripes. We cannot ignore the troubling history that brought us to this, our glorious institution, with its memorials and monuments to honorable men, and call ourselves a family. And we're damned if we think we're doing ourselves any favors, coloring the history one hue. One you, one we, one he, one she, one them, one we, one us, till we strive to see those stripes. The tiger cannot survive without it. The sight of the most exciting 25 seconds in college football was made possible by profits from the most shameful centuries in America's history. Those are the stripes we bear. And before you decide to wear that orange tee or that painted paw, think for a moment about those stripes. Think of the backs of the slaves. Think about the strips of land and the sharecroppers tied to it after so-called emancipation. Think of the uniform of that 13-year-old boy, a slave of the state, forced to help build the first buildings at this place. Think of the dark matters that matter more than you know, the difference between willing ignorance and active participation, complicit denial and abject perpetuation. Before you think solid orange, think of how ridiculous a solid orange tiger would look. Think of seeing its stripes. Think of being its stripes. And think of how terrible it is to not be seen, to not be acknowledged. Think about never being doomed to repeat an atrocious history and being better because of knowing better and doing better. Because as things are now, we are the tigers, built on a legacy of slavery, sharecropping, and convict labor. By slave owners, supremacists, and segregationists, but come to the campus of Clemson University, and you'd hardly be able to tell it from looking around. And it's a shame. We'd be a beautiful tiger if only we could see our stripes.
So, quite moving, but an incredible testament to what people are feeling across our campuses in the United States. It's about not, oh, see, thank you. It's about not being heard. It's about not being listened to. It's not acknowledging. It's not understanding. And let me see if I can get this to move forward now. Thank you. So, this is what happened this year in April. They had a national sit-in where students were sleeping out. This is the front steps of the president's office. And students slept out for 9 days. Asking for demands. And this happened, it was a nationwide sit-in because of the racial tensions that exist in the U.S. and because there are demands that aren't being met and action not being taken. So this is Clemson's campus where the sit-in took place 9 nights. And here's what happened from that. In fact, this slide's a little bit old. I should say this clipping is a little bit old. It's actually 85 universities. So student groups from 85 universities across the nation made demands to their senior administration on their campuses. And what they said is, we need more diverse faculty, we need more diverse student body, we need improved ethnic studies departments, we need an administrative apology. Our students group actually asked for acknowledgement from our senior administration and just said, would you just acknowledge that we're here and we're out here. Removal of school leaders, if there's no action on creating an inclusive environment, improved mental health services, zero tolerance for hate speech, and diversity training. And I will tell you, in the 9 days it was there, because I was also housed in that same building, I actually witnessed people driving by yelling out expletives and awful, hateful things to students who were out there just trying to be heard. So it's an interesting time in U.S. Higher education. So this is how many diverse faculty and student demands among North American universities were put out in just that short period of time in April when they did that national sit-in. And I will tell you that this is actually paralyzing some presidents across campus because they don't know how to respond to this. And often, they're afraid to say something. This is where it's going to become important when you hear about crisis management. There is a time to respond, and there's the right thing to say. And I think presidents are struggling with that right now. Some have lost their jobs because they either didn't respond, they didn't do so in a timely manner, or it was just inappropriate the way that they did it. So what I'm going to focus on now is, I hope I set the stage for you a little bit about the context of racial tensions, diversity, and what we've been doing, kind of the issue that's going on right now. Really, there has been this call to action on universities across campus. And I will tell you, we do not have a magic bullet here. Everybody's kind of doing their own thing and trying to do what's best at their institution, but there are a set of recommendations that universities actually can do. And there's a set of bullets up here that can tell you exactly what we looked at on Clemson's campus. It's really knowing who your community is and who your community is going to be. So there's an awareness piece there. Just like you saw in that See the Stripes, See the Stripes is all about ignoring the history of Clemson University and how it was built. And people are saying, just know who your community is and who you want to attract in the future. Commit to very frank, hard dialogues that exist. We had 3 open forums on day 7 when the students slept out on the front steps of the building. We had 3 open forums, and I was amazed and moved by what people had to say in a room with the senior leadership there about how uncomfortable they felt, how unwanted they felt, and how unvalued they felt as people from diverse backgrounds. It was very moving. You need to invest in culturally competent practices, and I'll show you how we did this on our campus. Set and monitor those goals, and make sure that you align resources towards it. Here was the problem at Clemson University. They had a chief diversity officer, and I'll talk a little bit about the structure that we have. We have chief diversity officers and chief diversity offices that actually manage a lot of this. They had a chief diversity officer with no direct line to the president and no budget. That means that it's not a priority. That's where the issue lies at Clemson University. That has all changed, but that resource piece is really important. And in fact, there are some universities right now who have dedicated $50 million to reverse what's going on from a diversity and equity standpoint. So universities are putting huge amounts of money to try to backtrack some of the issues that are going on here. So develop and pursue a clear vision and goal for diversity and inclusive excellence. Expect your students to produce signature work that is around inclusive excellence. So that can be senior research papers, that can be internship experiences, that can be working within communities to provide them some experiences. Provide support to students to help them develop guided plans for completion, so along the lines of what Joanne actually talked a lot about, to make sure that we take students in who are diverse and from different backgrounds, but create a plan so that they can be successful doing that. Identify high-impact practices. That's what HIP is, high-impact practices suited for your institution. It's not one-size-fits-all. Ensure essential learning outcomes and high-impact practices are incorporated across the curriculum and make student achievement for all visible and valued so that people know exactly where we stand. So from an infrastructure perspective, this varies greatly. And I'll tell you, in my research, when I was doing this strategic plan framework, there's really, you can put it into 2 buckets. It's either centralized or decentralized. A lot of U.S. institutions have a centralized office that has a chief diversity officer and an office that's usually called the Office of Equity and Inclusion or Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion or some form of that. This chief diversity officer has a direct line to the president, and that is incredibly important for someone in this office. They have a centralized vision and mission. They have a set of metrics that they want to meet. They have a set of outcomes, and there's a budget that's aligned to those particular metrics. One of the issues that I saw with this model was that the university as a whole will rest their entire diversity platform on the shoulders of that one person or that one office. So it doesn't truly get interwoven into the culture of what that university is. So what some universities have opted to do in the United States is take this decentralized approach where the efforts are really driven from within units. And I think what you call them here are faculties. So that would mean that the onus is on the faculties as opposed to this one unit. So there's in the faculties, there would be faculty champions with a diversity advisory board that actually reports directly to the president. Often there's not a direct line report in the decentralized model. That's one drawback of it. So I see that in this con, sometimes there's a little oversight and a lack of shared vision and a lack of accountability that exists in that. The model that we move forward with at Clemson is both of those. There's a chief diversity officer and a chief diversity, an office of equity and inclusive excellence, but then we're moving towards building unit or what you would call faculty champions to take care of the work that really needs to be done within those particular faculties. So here's another thing that we did as part of ours. We knew that because of these racial tensions that existed, we know that we needed to build a commitment to diversity statement that was signed by the Board of Trustees, the senior leadership, both student groups, that's out there on the website. Now, it's not on the website now. We've developed it, but we have to have those groups sign this that say that they're committed to this as a university, as an institution of higher learning, that we're committed to diversity because it enriches the educational experience for all of our students, and it's steeped in the history of what a land-grant institution is really all about. It's about service to the state. We also aligned it with the university strategic plan. And that is clearly articulated within that vision and mission of Clemson University. We also developed, I'm going to show you here in the next few slides, a comprehensive and actionable strategic plan that was short-term. So 3 years, 5 years at best. I'm getting hanging here. So the framework, I will tell you, was developed from information that was already collected on Clemson's campus. So I was asked to put this framework together. It wasn't my idea. It was built on information that was collected from the past 3 to 5 years at Clemson's campus because it really needed to be a Clemson activity. We also looked at reports from external consultants, and I looked at a couple of other models across the United States, and here's what we came up with. We needed to focus on these six areas, and here they are on this slide. We needed to have diversity and inclusive excellence in our education and training, in our climate and infrastructure, so we had to figure out how we create that academic and work environment so everybody could be successful. We had to have it built into our recruitment and retention, our research and scholarship, our strategic partnerships, and our leadership support and development. So it's very comprehensive. It hits all areas of the campus. And these are what we call our pillars of excellence once we get there. This is not meant for you to read, but what I wanted to, and the point I always make with our faculty and staff within our institution is that we want this to be actionable. It should fit on one or two pages. It shouldn't be a 200-page document that we throw up on the shelf and never look at again. So that is exactly what we went for. And you can see each of the purple boxes are one of our pillars that we have up there. We engaged our faculty across the campus, faculty, staff, and students, to build the plan for us. So they actually, and this is the action piece, so for every one of those pillars that we have, they drill down into the objectives, the tactics, the timelines, the metrics, the persons responsible, the resources that are needed. And this is really what made it actionable. And this is what we think is going to keep our president in his presidency. Because if we don't have that action, it's really going to be rough. I'm going to quickly go through this page just to say that this is really a process for us that involved significant communication across the campus and work group assignments so that we can get this work down to the units where that work really needs to be done. Once they do the strategic plan framework, they're actually going to start implementing those tactics and timelines across the university, and they're going to do biannual reporting. And that's where we can really make sure that it's accountable and being actionable. And the thing that I want to leave you with is an article that just came out May of 2016, which is titled "The Hard Truth About Race on Campus." And it says, after recent protests, universities are scrambling to expand their diversity programs that will only heighten tensions. And I think the reason why I put this out here is because We're still not sure what we're doing here. So I don't have the best practice for you, but I did share what we're doing at Clemson University, which has kind of calmed the waters a little bit. But I know that we still have a lot of work to do on our end. But that's what we have for our end.
Can be used in any crisis situation that you're in. I want to speak a little fast to keep us on time, so if there's anything, please stop me and ask.
I was just going to say, does anyone mind if I fly around and take a few photos while we're going?
Thanks.
Yeah, cool.
So let me go into, in 2015, there were more than 23 acts of violence on American college universities' campuses, college and university campuses. On top of that, worldwide, there were more than 198 acts of natural disasters at campuses across the world. And as we all know, terrorism is on the rise globally. Why is that important? That's important because our students are, we're getting international students, we have students studying abroad. So for us, it used to be the question of if a crisis happened on your campus. For us, it's no longer a question of if, it's when. And we have to be prepared because when you're waiting to a crisis hits and you're trying to create a plan, you've lost time, you've lost your credibility. So we define crisis as acts of violence, natural disaster, data breach, biological hazards, and behavior threats. We've had about three of those on our campus so far. We've had the natural disaster, which I'll talk about in this picture. You see up there was our campus 5 years ago, underwater. And this was my first time dealing with a natural disaster on our campus. And we've also had data breach. That is a major crisis as well. Especially when you think about we're giving our data to corporations like EAB and Noel Levis and all these people, and it's breached. And so now you have student social security numbers out for the United States, all of their background information. And in the United States, identity theft is huge. So that's another issue. And we've had a bomb threat on our campus. So we've kind of had to handle several things. I wasn't there for the bomb threat, thankfully, but I did handle the other two. I'm going to set the stage for you. I'm going to show you a quick video. Setting the stage, on September 8th, 2011, Tropical Storm Lee unleashed a flurry of rain for states across the United States, from the southernmost tip to the east coast. And I live in Pennsylvania, so on September 9th, President Obama, he announced 42 areas, including Pennsylvania, as natural disaster areas. And at that point, our river that flows through our town had crested at 32.75 feet. We were underwater. And it wasn't just our campus. Our campus actually was on the hill, so we were one of the lucky ones. But all the people in the town, which means some of your students who live there, your faculty, and your staff. Now imagine handling and running communications, and my house is underwater. And you have to deal with this, because you have to think about this type of situation.
Would you play that?
Normalcy is gradually making its way back onto our campus. Unfortunately, that's not the case for so many in our community. The Susquehanna River has since receded to normal levels after cresting to a record of nearly 33 feet. Yet its wrath, along with Fishing Creek's, remains vivid in our minds and will never be forgotten. Images of the flood of 2011 speak much louder than words, evoking strong emotions of despair, loss, and frustration. Recovery from a natural disaster of this magnitude will take months, if not years. Meanwhile, Bloomsburg University will continue to actively meet the needs of our community and be a resource for our region. During this trying time, we have proudly served our close-knit community, which helps make this institution a great place to live, learn, and work. The university has notably housed Pennsylvania National Guard troops and a rescue pet shelter on campus, provided shuttle buses and heavy equipment to assist with cleanup efforts, worked with Bloomsburg School District to provide alternative venues for their athletic events, and funneled countless students, faculty, and staff volunteers into town and neighboring communities, all of whom exhibited tremendous selflessness, civic engagement, and community pride. our students, more than 300 strong while the university was closed for 10 days, helped flood victims by hauling appliances and waterlogged furniture from soaked homes, clearing debris while kneading in mud, and emptying buckets of sludge from flooded basements. Many of these volunteers were student athletes who assisted residents in between games and practices without knowing when their own next shower could come. Untold numbers of volunteer efforts have been made by faculty and staff, including volunteering daily with the Red Cross and Agape, assisting thousands of flood victims. Thank you for putting into practice our Bloomsburg University core values. You can take great pride in knowing that the extra efforts you exhibited made a difference for so many people in our community.
The reason why I showed you that, this is what happened after the flood. When the flood hit, we had over 10,000 students on campus, and it was the middle of the day. And our president, we had, well, in America, in the United States, you have to have an emergency management team. You have to, and it consists of three groups. You have your executive policy group, which are your vice presidents, your, here would be your vice chancellors and your provost, and they have to look at who is impacted. What are we going to do? Then you have your incident command center, which is basically who's assessing the situation, who's telling us what's happening, how we want to run this, and then your operations group, how we're going to feed these students. We had no power. So imagine trying to run communications with no power. How are we going to communicate with these students? Social media. And then we had to think about how are we going to house them? What about the students who are thinking about leaving, going home? What do we do? And that was a critical question for us. Do we cancel classes at 2 o'clock and allow our students to get on the road and try to go home to their families when we know that the roads are underwater? So we took a lot of flack because we did not. We told the students classes were deferred, knowing that we were going to cancel classes. And we canceled classes at 6 o'clock, and we purposefully did that so that they would not get on those roads. We had people stuck on the freeway trying to get to their kids in our university, in our town. We had our own faculty and staff stuck trying to get to their children. I was one of them. I could not leave. You had schools releasing kids, saying we have to send them home. So, and we have a child daycare on our campus. So can you imagine the chaos? Had we been waiting for a communication plan, had we waited to build a communication plan at that time, we would have lost all credibility. So one of the first things that you have as part of your crisis communication, you have to have a plan already in place. And that plan, you have to act first, you have to communicate first and often, because you have to be as thorough as possible, and you have to be quick about it. And the first thing we did is we sent out an email, and we used social media beyond the email. We sent a tweet and said, we know what's happening. Basically, here's what's going on from a weather-wise. Classes have been delayed. Stay tuned to this channel. We went out and made sure that you understood that we are the official source of communication. That is very important, because what happened was we had students tweeting everyone. We had the media saying everything, and people were saying, what is going on? And when we went out first with that, after all the hearsay, that established us as the first line of contact. We also turned around and said, what are our most important goals and communications? In any crisis communication, you need to think about that. Our number one goal was the safety of our students. Our second goal was the safety of our faculty and staff, because we needed them as well. The other thing was, all of my communication people, some of them had gotten home, and I had to communicate with them via phone or via social media. And that happened across the university. You had to figure out how we're going to communicate. So when we pulled our team together, people had to take on different roles, and you have to be flexible. You have to be willing to do that. So what we started doing was, we knew that our TVs were out. We knew that in some areas the phone lines were too jammed. Everyone was trying to call. So after the first communication, the second communication went out. Here are the ways we will contact you. We made our student media, we made our local bloggers and our local media extensions of our PR team. We went and we contacted them via phone. We called every contact we knew. We also said, I would be the official spokesperson, if not me, my president. And I equipped every person on our team, even those in the executive policy leadership group, with the key messages. Because you can't have five different people responding on your behalf. You have to say, this is your official person, and everyone needs to know what you're talking about. So as I said, our first goal was, we need to, number one, make sure our students are safe.
Thank you.
So basically, I'm rushing through this really quick. You have to, it's very important to communicate first and often and only convey the facts when they're known. It's okay to say we don't know that yet. In fact, it's better to say that. If you communicate something you don't know, then you're going back and you're trying to eat your words and you're causing confusion. Also, monitor the news sources. We pulled out every laptop, every phone, and I think that's when I discovered the power of the portable power set, the power cords, because we needed to see what were people saying about us. What were the media reports being said? Where do we need to go back and correct and tell the students that's not correct information? The reason why that was important, for the first time in our history, we closed our university for 10 days. We had never done that. So we had to be accurate, because the first thing students were like, well, I had an exam today. What am I going to do about this exam? I'm graduating. What's going to happen here? So we had to really think this through. And one of the things we did was we started communicating, and we continued to communicate. We let them know that every hour or any time there was new information, we were going to communicate with you again. Also, I had someone on my team document every time a communication went out, every time a media inquiry came in, every action we made, every time we had an emergency meeting, and we documented not only what was said, but the time. You have to have that timeline, because how else will you measure the effects of your communication? You have to be able to go back when this is all done. Once the crisis is contained, your communication is not over. That is really the beginning of what is to be a long-term strategy. So we were able to go back and look and say, okay, what were the lessons learned through this process? What you saw, we couldn't show you all the water in the video because we couldn't get out and get that, but we were able to get some of those images. Our students barely had water on campus, but we became a resource for the whole community. I began to speak for the whole community, not just for my university, because we were there serving them. We had the National Guard on our campus. We had people, I lived with my president, my family lived with my president for a week trying to, because he had water. We had students they stayed on campus because they were athletes and they might have had a competition somewhere else and they couldn't go home. So they went down knowing that they could not even take a shower, and they were cleaning out houses. They were helping refurbish. It was just amazing the way we came out, the things we did. We could not have asked for that PR. That was the most positive PR we could have done, and we didn't do it for that. We do it because we are one university, one town. And that really solidified us as a united community. We went down and we had, even some of the faculty who were impacted went down and started answering phones on the Red Cross. We had to log that too, because we needed to know who were those faculty who were also impacted. And that was very key, because you need to understand your messaging and you have to be sensitive. Every message that we put out, we had to determine, was this for a student or was this for faculty or staff who was impacted? And then on top of that, so we had the flexibility to change. We were agile, rotational growth. But then on top of that, we had to communicate, how are we going to make up the classroom instruction time? And how would this impact their graduating on time? Because 10 days is a lot when you think about that from a student and instruction perspective. So we started communicating and thinking about what do we need to do. And everyone was so helpful in the fact that they decided that we were not going to add on extra days. They were going to bring in technology and do, blended learning. And they were going to have classes at certain times, and they would allow students to watch the video of lectures if they needed to. They were also going to come in and say, we weren't going to host Saturday classes. We decided, no, this was not anyone's fault. We had to figure out how to make this happen. So everyone started working on how do we change this scenario for our students and how do we make this the best fit for everyone. That, again, we had to communicate that. How do we communicate for those who are impacted? When do you return to work? What about the student whose family was impacted by this flood? Are we going to allow them extra time to not return to campus? And how would they make up their work? Because you can't say in one department that it's okay for you and in another department that it's not. So we had to have those conversations as well. We also had to think about what happens in the event, did we lose any students? That was very critical, because we had to count for every student. And it was easy to account when everything was going on because we had them contained. When they left, because naturally you open up campus finally and say, okay, you're free to go, everyone's going to leave. So when they left campus, then we had to account for who went home. Think about that when you guys have a huge number of students. How would you account for that? And that was one of the things we had to make phone calls. We had to say, okay, when campus reopened, how did we know that everyone was on campus? Thankfully, we had no fatalities. And I believe that was because we really, everyone, it was you cared after everyone. So that was all part of a communications plan, too. One of the things I forgot to include is the Jean Cleary Act in the United States says that in case of an emergency or any act that puts any student at immediate danger, you must communicate within 45 minutes of being notified. So think of the pressure. You're trying to deal with, we don't know what this storm is going to do. We don't know how to advise you, and we have to communicate to you within 45 minutes. Had we waited to figure out a time at that time, what is our plan, we would not have been successful. We have plans. We've done. You have to have simulated exercise before time. You have to have tabletop exercise. You have to have some type of practices. But I will guarantee you, everything you learn during those practices will go out the door when you're standing facing a crisis. But you'll have the background, and you must be calm. You must be calm in all of this. I did that really quick because of time. And I think I finished it. But if you have any questions, I'll be willing to answer.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right.
Well, thank you very much. I'm sure that we've got a few questions just before we go and enjoy our afternoon tea. Just thought it was a fascinating insight from each of your perspectives. So thank you very much.
I've got a question. I've always been surprised when you have, like, things like open day out on campus and you had all the signs and it makes it as easy as possible for everybody who comes along the campus. It's great. And then they take them all down. And then there's students wandering around, always get lost, and all these lessons you learn, like, that's not a crisis, but you think, well, why don't they just leave those signs up so everybody could actually know where they're going all the time? From your crisis point of view, were there things later on you thought, gee, why don't we just do that all the time?
Yes.
How we communicate with our students or different types of students or people on the campus rather than only in the crisis?
Yes. One of the things we learned, we have a 1-800 crisis line. That was one of the things. And no one ever called that, so we didn't bother to build that phone. And at that time, we found we needed to man the phone, that some people like old-fashioned communication. We also learned that a lot of people, I didn't know that we had a shelter on campus. And then all of a sudden, this became very popular. So we had to start. We started talking more about what's available on campus for our community and where can you go for help. So that became part of our regular communications.
Okay, well, I think as we'll all be out here, I'm sure there's other questions that will come, but please just join me in thanking the three fellows.